This is a podcast from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find our webpage at www.wsm.ie. This is a podcast recorded at the second Dublin Anarchist Book Fair on Saturday the 3rd of March 2007. There were speakers from the Workers' Solidarity Movement, the Irish Socialist Network and IRE discussing the question, what sort of Ireland do we want? This speaker is from the Irish Socialist Network.
When I had to start preparing for this talk about what kind of revolution we could have in Ireland, it made me think of my uncle's career as a would-be Irish revolutionist. He was my age in the early 60s, and he was living in London. He was a member of a very ambitious group called the Irish Castro Movement, and they were inspired by the example of Fidel and Che. And so their plan was they were going to come back to Ireland in a boat, take to the Wicklow Mountains, fight their way down, eventually march into Dublin to liberate the people. And you can probably guess it didn't quite work out like that. I don't think it ever had more than 2 years. We should all be aware of that when we talk about revolution, most people who aren't revolutionaries have a very powerful image and stereotype of what that means. That's not likely to be relevant to a country like Ireland. To begin with, first of all, obviously we have to define our goal of what we're trying to achieve. And for the ISN, our goal is to create a socialist democracy. And that means, above all, democratic control over the economy. And to be more specific, that means that the key sectors of the economy have to be put under social ownership and control, which is not the same thing as state ownership. You can have state ownership in a totalitarian state. And it doesn't mean either, it doesn't mean nationalising every single corner shop, but it does mean that the banks, the major industries and so on have to be taken over, because if you leave them under the control of big business, that means abandoning the goal of economic democracy. This doesn't mean either creating a centrally planned economy like the old Soviet Union, because a genuine socialist democracy would be about as far from that model as you can imagine. A socialist democracy has to base itself on direct participation by the working class in decision making. To prevent a system that's based on democratic planning rather than the market from clogging up with bureaucracy, you need to decentralise power as much as possible. Some decisions will have to be made at national level, but wherever possible, there shouldn't be any question of things all being directed from the centre. Depending on what most practical decisions should be made at a regional level, or they should be made within an industry as a whole, or within one factory, or even within a unit within a factory. And at every level, power should be in the hands of elected delegates who are accountable to the people who are affected by their decisions. There's no question at all, a system like this would be very complicated and it would take a lot of work, but there's no way you can run a modern industrial economy without a complex system. There's nothing simple or straightforward about capitalism. And there's no denying either that there would be problems, there would be drawbacks, and we're not talking about creating a perfect system. Anyone who tells you we can create a perfect system is a charlatan and shouldn't be trusted. We're talking about creating a system that's better than capitalism with all the problems that it brings. So it should also be obvious that a system like this would require new political structures. The very limited form of democracy that we have under capitalism has to be expanded radically. Political power has to be decentralised along with economic power. And whenever possible, decisions should be made at a local level by the communities that are affected by them. That's not always possible, of course, because there are some decisions that have to be made at a national level or not at all. And there has to be some kind of central body that can adjudicate between different interests, because it's pure fantasy to think that any kind of social conflict will disappear once we get rid of capitalism. It's fine to say that all decisions should be made by worker councils or community councils, but what if councils in different parts of the country disagree with each other? You do need to have a national assembly of some kind with the power to settle disputes and make policy at a national level. But we're talking about an assembly that would be very different from the Dáil or the House of Commons. No doubt the structures involved will probably differ from one country to the next, because capitalist democracy, as we know, takes on very different forms from one country to another. So socialist democracy is bound to be the same. One suggestion that I find attractive is the idea of a two-chamber system, where one chamber will be directly elected, the other chamber will be made up of delegates from the councils around the country. And whatever structure you end up adopting, there have to be safeguards that will prevent the formation of a political elite that's cut off from the people it represents. What those safeguards would be has been fairly clear ever since the time of the Paris Commune in the 19th century, that you need to have term limits so you get a regular rotation of people at the top. You need to have structures in place that allow delegates to be recalled if they break their mandates, and delegates should be paid no more than the average working class wage so that politics doesn't become a career. There's another thing that would be very important for a system like this in order for it to function. I was talking about separation of powers, and this is an idea that people on the radical left have often neglected, probably because they associate it with the practice of capitalist democracy, where usually under capitalism separation of powers only exists in theory, goes to the wall when the stakes are high enough. We've seen that with the record of the British state in Northern Ireland, that when the military wing of the state gunned down peaceful protesters in Derry on orders from the political wing of the state, it was up to the judges, in theory, to hold them accountable. And of course, Lord Widgery did nothing of the sort. On the contrary, he whitewashed the record. And Lord Denning had the same attitude with the Birmingham Six. But that doesn't mean that the idea of putting checks and balances into the system is completely worthless. It just means that it doesn't work that way under capitalism. In a socialist democracy, there will have to be a legal system that's distinct from a political system, that has the job of upholding a constitution that guarantees people basic democratic freedoms. Sometimes minority rights have to be defended against the majority, and that's not going to disappear when capitalism is gone. So that's an outline of the goal that we should be aiming towards, and there's plenty more that can be said about that, plenty of gaps that you need to fill in, and plenty of questions that we need to be able to answer, but that'll do for now. So the next question is how. First of all, what social forces do you base yourself on? And socialists of all sorts, from social democrats to anarchists, have always said that the key social force is the working class. And that view has come under attack in recent decades from within the left. And as I see it, there's two main line of arguments here. There's a positive one and a negative one. To begin with the negative argument, people say there's no point appealing to the working class in countries like Ireland because it's a busted flush. In countries like our own, the working class doesn't have enough social weight to carry through any kind of left-wing project, never mind a revolutionary one. And any political movement that wants majority support has to win over the middle classes, so that rules out radical policies. There is a grain of truth in that, and there's a whole heap of distortion. It's true that there has been a change in the makeup of the workforce in most developed countries. There's fewer industrial workers, and there's a lot more white-collar workers. But the conclusions that people draw from that are very dubious. There is no reason in principle why white-collar workers should be hostile to socialism, and there's plenty of evidence in practice to show that they can be won over by the left and the workers' movement. There's a casual assumption there that anyone who doesn't get their hands dirty when they work is very affluent and very conservative, and there's actually no basis for that. In fact, the whole discussion that we have about class is distorted by the very existence of class society. Obviously, the dominant class is able to promote ideas that help to prop up its position, and one way to convince people that there's no alternative to status quo is to make out that the working class is a powerless minority. But there's a more subtle form of distortion which takes root because the people, for the most part, who take part in the discussion about class, journalists and academics, don't represent society as a whole. The number of working class people who can make it into those professions is still very small, so that has a big influence on what people say. And that helps explain why earlier this year there was so much confusion when an opinion poll in Britain showed that 57% of people considered themselves working class. That didn't make any sense to the experts. It went against all the received wisdom. And it never occurred to them that maybe people know better than the experts about their own position in society. But let's not forget that when we start talking about class, there is a problem of language, that when socialists use the term, they usually mean anyone who earns a wage or a salary, anyone who has to sell their labour to survive. In everyday language, there's a much more restrictive definition. There's a bit in the Adrian Mole diaries when Adrian starts taking an interest in left-wing politics, and he goes off to the library and gets a copy of The Condition of the Working Class in England by Frederick Engels, and when his dad sees it, he flips his lid and says, "I've worked long and hard to bring this family into the middle class, and I'm going to have my son admiring proles and revolutionaries." Adrian writes in his diary, "Dad is kidding himself if he thinks we're middle class now. He still puts HB sauce in his toast at breakfast." I'm sure anyone can think of their own example, you know. We can't ignore that people have this common sense definition of class, and we have to reckon with that, but it doesn't need to be a huge problem. What matters to the left is political identity rather than cultural identity. People can have a really strong sense of themselves as being working class, but still vote Fianna Fáil, or even BNP for that matter. Let's say a group of teachers goes on strike. It's a long struggle, but they win in the end. They make some gains, and they become radicalised in the process, and they identify with the workers' movements. They're sympathetic to socialist ideas. At that stage, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter a damn whether they consider themselves working class or middle class in the cultural sense. There's another argument, though, it's a more positive argument that was quite popular on the left in the 70s and 80s, not so much nowadays. What people said was that instead of relying on the working class, the left should put its faith in the new social movements that were coming forward. Either they base themselves on different social identities like gender or race, or they base themselves on an issue that cut across class boundaries like peace or ecology. I should have been clear at the time that this was a very short-sighted view, and it certainly is now, because a movement like feminism may hope to base itself on women as a whole, but it can't help but be affected by the class divisions and class conflicts in society. In most countries, the feminist movement is split between activists who are happy with formal legal equality and activists who want more, who want the kind of economic change that can make equal rights a reality for working class women. You get the same problem with the Green movement. You can't talk about protecting the environment without taking a stand on the way the economy is organised. So on the one hand, you get the Irish Green Party saying Greens mean business, and on the other hand, you get eco-socialists who reject capitalism. Social movements can't exist outside of class politics. But there is an important point here that shouldn't be overlooked. In the not-so-distant past, the workers' movement was effectively the only social movement, and that time is long gone, so movements like feminism and ecology have to be welcomed as equal partners. So how is the working class going to change society? What kind of organisation does it need? There's a lot of distrust these days when you start mentioning parties. Some people appear to think that any kind of political organisation or leadership is authoritarian by its very nature. We disagree completely with this view of the ISN. So you have to ask yourself, what is the alternative? Some people might say spontaneous action by the working class, which is all very well, but in practice, there's no such thing as spontaneous action in the pure sense of the term. Because any time there's a strike or an occupation or a mutiny, somebody has to take the initiative and give the lead to the others. You never get a situation where several thousand workers all at the same time decide that they're going to go on strike. When we call something spontaneous, what we really mean is that it was initiated by people who weren't recognised political activists. Socialist revolution, as we understand it, isn't going to happen without political organisation. A spontaneous protest movement may be able to bring down a government, but it won't be able to lay the foundations for an alternative society. There's just too many wrong turnings that can be taken along the way. It's vital to have an organised political force that can give a lead to the working class. The Italian socialist Antonio Gramsci had a nice way of putting it when he said that the party should be the collective intellectual of the working class. In other words, it should be the place where activists from all the different social movements come together, discuss their own experiences, look at what's happened before, what previous generations have done, and draw conclusions and come up with political strategies based on those experiences. Every revolution and mass movement that we've seen over the last 100 years or more has taught us one important lesson, that social struggles are always uneven. They have their ebbs and their flows. They don't continue at the same level all the time, which is only natural because going against the grain of the social order is never easy. It always brings trouble for the people who go down that path, often very serious trouble. Radical movements usually reach a peak, then they begin to retreat if they don't make the crucial breakthrough. You need to have a political force that can concentrate the energies of all the different social struggles into a challenge for power. Of course, that begs the question, what kind of political force? A lot of distrust towards the whole idea of parties and leadership is very understandable when you look at the actual type of parties that the left has often produced. So for starters, one thing should be clear, it doesn't have to be a single party that plays this role. It's very unlikely that one organisation can represent all the currents of opinion, even among the most radical sections of the working class and the social movements. So when we talk about an organised political force, it could be an alliance of parties. There also has to be pluralism within parties. There has to be room for different currents of opinion. The model of a tightly centralised, monolithic organisation has to be ditched. Members need to have the right to organise themselves into factions or platforms, putting across their own point of view. And another thing is vital, that members of a party should have the right to disagree with the majority line in public. Even with small organisations, it's not healthy when debate is kept behind closed doors. It creates the potential for abuse by the leadership. But once you start talking about mass politics, it becomes very damaging. Because if you have worker councils or radicalised trade unions where a big chunk of the membership belongs to a political party, it will completely deform the democratic functioning of those bodies if the party activists go off on their own, make a decision and then try to impose that line by presenting a united front. There has to be give and take. And that feeds into a broader question, how any organisation should see its relationship with the working class. Very often parties of activists, if they can work out the correct programme, then go to the masses and tell them what they should do. And that attitude has to go. Because all we can hope to do on our own is to work out a provisional programme, a starting point for a discussion that's based on past experience. We need to be listening out for the demands that are emerging from social movements and adapt our own programme to take account of those demands. Our job is to help people find their own voice and not to speak on their behalf. I've already said that one of the ISN's main goals is to create new political structures that allow much more room for mass participation in the form of capitalist democracy that we have at present. So if that's our goal, then why do we participate in the existing structures as we have done already, as we will be doing again this year? Why not attempt to build a mass movement completely independent of electoral politics? And as I understand it, the case for abstention from parliamentary politics is based on two assumptions, both of which I find unrealistic. And the first assumption is that you can create new political structures without participating in the old ones in any way. There's a lot of political experience that suggests this is not a viable strategy, at least in countries like Ireland. In places like France and Italy, the new left of the 1960s usually followed an abstentionist path. It wasn't the only reason why those forces were unable to mobilise enough support to carry through the kind of revolution they had in mind, but it certainly made a big contribution to that failure. And we have to recognise the fact that parliamentary systems in the developed world have put down deep roots. They've been in place for decades, if not centuries. That doesn't mean they're invulnerable, not by any means, but it seems very unlikely that we can simply bypass them. And the second assumption probably helps to underpin the first. And I'm talking about the assumption that once you get involved in electoral politics, sooner or later you will be forced to abandon radical goals and find yourself sucked into the logic of administering the system as it is. And at a first glance, the history of the socialist movement in the 20th century would seem to confirm this view. Because not only have the social democrats been converted into pillars of the capitalist order, but even the big communist parties in Western Europe have been happy to serve in governments that pose no threat to capitalism whatsoever. But we need to look a bit more closely. It's not very surprising that an organisation like the British Labour Party, for example, should have evolved into such a conservative force, because whatever about the views of a section of its membership, Labour has never, ever in its history been led by people who seriously thought about replacing capitalism with socialism. If you want to judge the record of parliamentary socialism, it's better to look at the experience of parties that weren't happy to rule over a capitalist society, parties that actually considered in practical terms how they might bring about a transition to socialism. There's quite a few examples of parties like that, and if you look at their record, one thing stands out. They all believed that it was possible to take control of the existing state through the ballot box and then use it as a tool to transform society. We don't have time to go through a detailed historical survey, so it's best to look at one striking example, which is the government of Salvador Allende in Chile. Cheers, thanks. Allende and his allies in the Unidad Popular acted on the assumption that they could use the structures of the Chilean state to carry out their programme. So you have all kinds of tragic, comic statements from leaders of the government praising the Chilean army for its loyal, patriotic and constitutional attitude, statements that appear hopelessly naive when you remember what happened in September 1973. That went hand in hand with the belief that there was no alternative to relying on the existing state. In the last days of the government, when one of his advisors said to Allende, only the direct action of the masses will stop the coup, apparently he responded by saying, how many masses does one need to stop a tank? The experience in Chile had the effect of terrorising the European left at the time. In Italy, the Communist Party was on the brink of taking power through the ballot box in the mid-70s. When they saw what happened in Chile, they decided to pull back and offered to form a grand coalition with the right wing. They expected a coup if there was a left-wing government elected to office. Going down that road obviously means abandoning any idea of transforming society. But there's a very different lesson that can be drawn from what happened in Chile and what's happened in other countries. It shows that you can't take over the capitalist state and use it for socialist purposes, because it's not designed for that job. You have to assume that most people in the upper ranks of the state bureaucracy, the leading civil servants, judges, army officers and so on, will be completely hostile to the radical left and its programme. The only way to overcome that opposition is by mobilising people outside the structures of the state and by appealing to the people who are employed by the state over the heads of their bosses, including the soldiers. So that points towards a very different approach to parliamentary politics. It may be possible for a radical party or a radical alliance to win at the ballot box, but that won't give them the power to change society. Elections can be a spur to mass mobilisation, and often they have been, but without that mobilisation, it doesn't matter how many votes you win. So that is the attitude of the ISN when we take part in elections. We don't claim for a moment that it's going to be easy. We know very well what the dangers are, but it's just not true to say that this approach to electoral politics has been tried again and again and failed every time. In fact, it's barely been tried at all. Our view of elections is rooted in our whole concept of socialist democracy. We don't believe that change can come about from above through a parliamentary elite or a vanguard party. In the words of Rosa Luxemburg, socialism by its very nature can't be introduced by decree or proclamation. The very mass of the people must take part in it. And the role of socialist organisation is to make that possible.
You've been listening to a podcast recorded at the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair, Saturday the 3rd of March 2007. The speakers from the Irish Socialist Network talking about what sort of Ireland do we want. You can listen to the talks from the Workers' Solidarity Movement and Airgi at the WSM website, which is www.wsm.ie. This is a podcast from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find our webpage at www.wsm.ie.